season 5, what episode, we don't know, but it's okay. My name is Brandon Curry, and welcome to the first YouTube channel on the new Crier Media Network, where all 20,000 some odd of you, of our closest friends, are here, and this is the first stream on our YouTube channel. This is amazing. Thank you very much to everyone and that made this a go. My name's Brandon Curry. There he is.
I'm Jeff Collins.
I'm Josh Bond.
And Trevor Lindy.
And we've got some familiar guests. One familiar guest to our loyal fans. And also to one brand new guest who's really SMRT, much smarter than us. And that's why we are the Professional Insight Podcast. Mr. Frank DiPietro, CPA, CA, and Mr. Mike Evans, who's the Vice President of National Sales for McKenzie Investments, who's a big partner of our firm, C.R. Smith Financial, full disclosure. And again, more disclosure. There's nothing financial being exchanged. This is just purely for educational purposes, because this team here knows a ton about a ton. So we want
to
make sure
you don't have to declare a conflict if they're not greasing you, right? So
yeah, I just like to say it though. You know what I mean? Okay, like I just like
just make sure it's out.
You know,
that's good. Yeah, get that out of the way right off the bat.
That's right. Just get it out of the way. Right,
for all those,
and that's why
Bond,
and that's why Josh is my lawyer, because he makes sure I don't put my foot in it. That's pretty much it. And thanks very much to our sponsors, Brand Boulevard, Sync, Litch. Really appreciate it. They've been with us since day one, so thank you. Mike Evans, Frank, welcome back.
Thanks for having
Thank
me.
You very much.
Hello, Frank.
Thanks, Brandon. Thanks, great to be here, boys. This I've heard a lot about you. I can't wait to experience the show firsthand. This is going to be great.
So when Frank was on last, he did a little bit of his background, which we'll get to again, just to remind all of our viewers again. But Mike, can we just start with a little bit of your background, McKenzie, your role, and that kind of thing, and you know, just maybe a short career path for anyone that might be watching and might want to be the, you know, vice president of national sales for a fairly large mutual fund company
yeah.
in the future.
Quick clarification on the title: National Sales Initiatives is my title.
My bad. That's
which
on me.
Is great. I've been at McKenzie. I've been in financial services now for 32 years. I've been at McKenzie that whole time. Joined back in 1990, and it's kind of an interesting journey. I thought, you know, I'll tell you a bit of a background story on me. You might see some interesting things in my background. There's a little, you know, rock sample up here with some gold in it. I have a geology and exploration background. So
I was going to guess paleontology with the T-Rex or something.
Yeah, with the T-Rex model up there. That's kind of cool too.
That's awesome.
But yeah, so way back when I've been interested in trading stocks and in investing my whole life since I was a kid. And when I was at university, I took the securities course and thought, okay, when I get out, this is what I want to do. But I had people of influence in my family that were junior mining promoters that worked in exploration and development of mining companies at a very grassroots level, which took me all over Northern Ontario. I've been to, you know, South Porcupine, you know, all over the north, and Pickle Lake, Red Lake, been in planes that take you beyond where the roads end. And it was funny. I was doing a geological survey piece out in BC, Smithers, BC. And, you know, this is young men's work, right? You're in the bush, you're trudging around, snowshoes, uncomfortable, lots of things. And this one particular day, I was out there, and I was the generator guy. So we were doing these IP surveys where you put electricity in the ground and you measure lots of things that come from that. Anyway, I had what's akin to a lawnmower motor on a backpack on my back with a generator coil to it. I had a gas can in one hand, I had an axe in the other, and I was climbing an icy cliff. And I thought to myself, I could die doing this. I need to go back to Toronto and start working just with my brain. And so I survived that cliff climb and the rest of that project and everything else, and came back and started looking for opportunities in asset management and joined the industry's leader, Mackenzie Investments, and have been there ever since. And my roles have varied. I was on the inside sales team. I was a wholesaler. I was an RVP managing wholesalers. And now I've morphed into this role, guys, which I love because it allows me to kind of sink my teeth into and focus on areas of interest like retirement, which we're going to talk about today, and partner with folks like Frank DiPietro and others within the organization who are wonderful resources to helping develop value-added services that Mackenzie represents. And I love it. It's an area of tremendous growth and opportunity today as it was 32 years ago when I started. Give you a little tidbit. When I started in the business, there was $25 billion in mutual funds in the entire country, right? 25. And Mackenzie managed like half of that. Like it was crazy, our market share. Wind the clock ahead. Today, there's $2 trillion in mutual funds and ETFs and so forth. And it's done nothing but grow and become more important and successful. And it's an area of tremendous opportunity. So that's kind of my background and where I've come from, where I am, why I'm no longer climbing icy cliffs with lawnmower motors on my back, and why I see lots of potential, right? I think we've only scratched the surface on where we can go.
Don't you want to climb just one more cliff for old time's sake?
I do occasionally, right? I do that at the cottage, but in a far more safe fashion.
You jump off into the lake, right?
Exactly. Yeah. You're precisely right.
My father started on diamond drilling when he was 15.
Oh, wow.
I've done that. Diamond drilling, core sampling, assay preparation. Like there's guys and gals out there that are drilling holes in the ground looking for stuff, right? That's at a grassroots level. That's what happens in Canada to develop some of these resources. And that little rock over my shoulder has tons of VG, visible gold, in it. It's a great, great little sample.
You sure it's not iron?
And it's funny, and we... What's that?
I said, you sure it's not iron pyrite?
Oh, I'm 100% sure.
Fool's gold, right?
And we also, and then quickly we found out while we were waiting to come on in back in the green room, and you're one heck of a Scotch aficionado, which was so cool to have that. Like, you're an eclectic person, Mike. This is amazing.
I was impressed. Brandon, I'll tell you what, I do know my Scotch, and I told you the story about forming the Gulfdale Scotch Club over COVID to just find a way to kill time, right? But, you know, that's an impressive rail you've got behind you there, a nice, diverse range of some of the best Scotches, single malts in the world. So I think at some point we got to talk about that. And I wish I had a picture of my shelf. It's pretty good, too. Maybe not quite as good as that. But...
And Frank, the brain, hey, who I've known, how we've known each other for decades, you and I, right? Our families have been we're pretty tight.
Oh, yeah.
And thanks again for coming on. And thanks again for coming on a couple months ago. Yeah. It's really nice to have you on always.
Great. Thanks for having me as well.
Frank, you got any interesting stories about, death-defying things that propelled you into accounting?
Any lawnmowers on your back? We want to know.
What have you done that's the most dangerous?
Listen, Brandon, you asked Mike to do a brief introduction. And so if you're going to learn anything about Mike, there's nothing brief. So you're gonna get
guilty.
Yeah, but it's always great stories and great to listen to. No mountain climbing for me. My venture into this world was pretty straightforward. Coming from an immigrant family, my dad had a bricklaying business, and I thought maybe I'd take over the family business, but that, like most other business, he actually did not want me to take over the family business. Because his back was broken by the time he was probably my age now. So he said, you're going to go get an education and work with your mind. So I said, finance and numbers and accounting is sort of where my headspace is at. So I've been in the financial services business for, over 20 years now. Much of that with Mackenzie and in tax and estate planning and helping advisors create more tax efficient strategies and helping with their estate planning, which is becoming more and more important, and helping Canadians retire more tax efficiently as well. So that's a real brief reintroduction of myself.
Well, and I just want to say thanks again for coming on. And we do, honestly, our families have known each other for a couple decades. And I mean, yeah, I hang with your brother quite a bit. Yeah. And on top of that, it's great to have Mackenzie as a partner and in our corner because as advisors, you just don't know everything, which is going to lead into my next question. And everyone on this panel, too, because the four of us really want to know. And I don't know who wants to tackle this, but that's the new home buyers plan that the federal government announced in their last budget for going into for F23 technically. And but we haven't heard much about it. I think you guys have more of the inside track for that. And who wants to tackle that?
I think they announced it in August, right?
Frank is our expert on all things tax related.
So it was actually budget 2022, which was released last April, that introduced the concept and proposal to create this. They call it new home buyers plan. Let's clear. This is a completely different program than what already exists, was the home buyers plan that allows you to withdraw $5,000 per individual from your RSP. For purpose of purchasing your first home. So in that case, what you're doing is essentially borrowing from your RRSP, and then there's a requirement to pay it. And to do that, there's no tax implications. You're not creating a tax liability when you take money out. That's one program that's still in place and available for Canadians. Now, as part of a series of tax measures to address the housing affordability crisis that we're sort of in the midst of in Canada been dealing with, there have been a series of proposals, one of them being, you mentioned, a brand new type of account that Canadians, particularly those who are trying to save for a down payment on the purchase of their home, account where individuals can contribute and create a savings plan to put towards the purchase of a first home, being defined as a first home save account, or FHSA, right? So we have RRSPs, we have TFSAs, and now we have an FHSA that is being 22 to come effective April 1st of 2023. So this is sort of what the government is saying is, look, as of April 1st, Canadians can now contribute to these plans. Services or financial institution perspective, everybody's kind of working hard in one to try and get these established so that Canadians contribute to them. So hopefully, Mackenzie, as well as other financial institutions, be ready by April 1st of 2020 to be able to contribute to. So what is it? So like an RRSP, the money you contribute to an FHSA is tax deductible. And as long as the money is inside this plan, it's tax deferred, meaning that there's no taxes on any of the investment income that's being generated within the plan. So that is the similarities with respect to an RSP. The idea as well is that if you use to put towards the purchase of your first home, then the money you take out of this new FHSA is going to be completely tax-free. So it's kind of a good deal, right? If you're somebody who's looking to save money for a down payment, you now have a plan that you can contribute to. The government will subsidize that by way of a tax savings or tax deduction. And then you can take that money out down the road when you're ready to buy your first home and take it out tax-free. That's unlike an RSP, which, you know, if you take money out, it's totally taxable.
So it's double. You're doubling up there, essentially, right?
Here we are.
Right?
The government's going to give you a tax break.
That's why I put it into RSPs, right? For the most part, I try to max out my RSP because I want, right now, my active income, I want to get that tax break, right?
Exactly. But you know down the road with respect to your RSP, if you take it out, it's all taxable. Now, through the home buyer's plan, you can take it out tax-free, but the difference with the home buyer's plan is you have to repay it. So every year, you're going to have to put a little bit of money back into your RSP to repay it. So it's like you borrow from your RSP. This new FHSA, there's no requirement to repay it. So once you take it out and use it to purchase your home, that's it. You close the account and away you go. So it's the government's way of trying to help Canadians deal with this affordability issue and help them, you know, have a few extra bucks in savings and tax deduction.
What was the cap? Was there a cap on it?
So it is, in my view, the cap is low. So they've set it at a lifetime limit of $40,000. And with an annual contribution limit of $8,000, right? So the idea is that we're going to open this up in 2023. The maximum contribution limit for 2023 will be $8,000. Now, let's say, you know, you have a client who, you know, we set up this account. They contribute $5,000 this year. Any of that contribution room that's not used can carry forward to the following year, much like your TFSA, right? So if you only contribute $5,000 in 2023, then in 2024, you have your an additional $3,000 plus the $3,000 unused from 2023. So in 2024, you can contribute up to $11,000 to your FHSA. Again, so there's annual limits as well as this $40,000 lifetime limit.
Now, big question for me. My eldest daughter is 14 years old.
Yeah.
I want to start. I always like to try to plan well in advance. How early can we start taking advantage of investing money into this? I presume 18.
Well, I mean, you want to think about, you know, one of the, I guess, restrictions with this new account is that once you open up the plan, you have 15 years to use it.
Okay.
Right. Okay. So think about a 15-year window. Yep. First of all. And
my kid would be buying that house within that 15 years, come hell or high water.
18. Buy at 18.
Hey, by 18. That's right. So, well, and you make a good point. You can't set this up for a minor, right? So a minimum requirement, they do need to be 18, right? So to be eligible to open it up, you have to be, of course, a resident of Canada. You have to be at least 18.
The standards, right?
And much like the home buyer's plan, you have to be considered a first-time home buyer. And it has essentially the same definition for the FHSA than you do for the home buyer's plan, which essentially says that you either have to be a first-time home buyer. So this is the first time you're purchasing, or if you have owned a home in the past, you or your spouse or partner cannot own a home in the last 4 years. So there are cases where individuals have perhaps owned a home in the past, but for whatever reason, maybe haven't over the last several years, and may re-qualify for, say, your home buyer's plan or now this FHSA. So answer your question, though, I mean, yes, you need to be at least 18, but you also need to ensure that, you know, you've got this 15-year window that they're going to use.
Is this per person, too? So a husband and a wife could do it, or correct, a boyfriend and girlfriend could both do it at the same time?
Yeah, so it's per combined person. And the other, I'll tell you, one update, really important update. So when the legislation or proposal was made back in April of last year in the federal budget, you know, one of the things most people sort of hesitated at was there was a restriction that you would either draw from your FHSA or from your home buyer's plan, but you couldn't do both. Yeah. Right. So if you got 40,000 in your FHSA mm-hmm. and you've got 35 in your RSP that you're going to use for home buyers, you know, you can only do one or the other, which kind of sucked. Right. Yep. So, but there was a release of a legislative update back in November, which is part of the overall fall economic update. Where there was new legislation. So one of the changes in that legislation is that Canadians will be able to utilize both, right? So got RSPs, and perhaps you now go through the process, say for your daughter when she turns 18, you start building up your FHSA, you start building up your RSP if when she begins working. And then down the road, when it's time to say buy a home, she will be able to draw 35 from her RSP and everything that has accumulated in her FHSA. So that could add up to quite a significant down payment on the purchase of her first home. And it is, you know, per individual. So down the road, if, you know, if there's a spouse or partner, then that's per individual, right? So now you can.
What if you want to buy a house with two couples, so four people up and down?
Every individual.
Every individual.
There's no limit on that then.
That's insane.
You could also, hey, Frank.
That's insane.
You could also throw in the TFSA, right? And there's dollars you could pull out and use for anything. So you put those three things together. That's a pretty significant opportunity.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's insane.
What happens if you hit that 15-year limit and you don't buy?
Yeah, so then there's going to be a requirement to collapse, right? So this idea of having this money come out tax free is only if you're purchasing your first home. If that doesn't happen within the 15 years or just
tax man cometh,
yeah. So then the withdrawals at that point, you know, the client is going to be forced to collapse that FHA, and all that money is going to be taxable.
Everybody's got to take advantage of this. Everybody's got to take advantage of this. That's crazy.
Now, if you're in the market to purchase your first home, and if you would otherwise be considered a first home buyer, right? Like, I'm not going to qualify. I'm not going
to
use this.
So just to recap, because it was a bit, there were some glitches there, just to make sure that everyone heard everything. So to recap, the first time home buyers plan. Withdrawal from the RSP is still in place. Tax-free savings account still in place. The new home buyers plan, or the first time home buyers, whatever the acronym is, that is being launched April of 2023. And it's like the TFSA and the RRSP had a baby. It's essentially you're taking the best of both accounts and you're allowed to have all three just firing in order to save. You have limits. I love it. And then on top of that, here's a question. From a financial planning perspective, can you, if you are the subscriber, meaning the owner of your own RRSP, can you do a sheltered transfer from the RSP into the first-time home buyers? Because you might, in theory, you can have more than $35,000 grow in that account, right? Because there's no limit to the withdrawal. There's a limit to the contributions.
Yes.
Am I right?
So you can do a transfer. You can transfer from your RSP to your this new FHSA, right? So you can use your RSP to fund it, and that would be a tax-free transfer from your RSP to your FHSA. But it's individual, so it would have to be my RSP going to
FHSA. I can't fund my daughter's.
Correct. Yeah, you can't transfer money from your RSP to your daughter's FHSA, right?
But can I fund her?
Yes. Account? So that's what I was going to say. So, but you know, you can give funds to your daughter who can then make those contributions. The government's been very clear, either for your daughter, or even if it's a spouse situation, there's not going to be any such thing as a spousal FHSA like there are with spousal RSPs. And we know there are rules that if we give our spouse money to contribute to an account or for savings, there's these nasty tax rules that'll always kind of hurt the person who's transferring the money. But in this case with the FHSA, you can give your spouse money to contribute to his or her FHSA or to your kids to make their own individual contributions to their FHSA.
Hey, Frank, so this brings up a great, you know, topic of conversation for us. And Brandon, you kind of kicked it off. Just what's the right thing for people to do? Say they've got some money this year. They get a bonus at year end. They've got some capital and they're saving for a house. They want to do that. What's the best sort of order of operation or combination of strategies? Do they max out their RSP contribution, get their refund, top up their TFSA, then go to the FHSA as like the third? In your overall opinion, is there an optimal approach? I guess there's many ways to tackle it, but what do you think? Like let's noodle it through for folks listening.
Yeah, it's
a question. Great question.
It is. And, you know, I've started to think about that, right? Like what's your best bet here? Do you FHSA, do you use your RSP, use the home buyers,
TFSA, the new account? It's gotta be.
Yeah. So if you have a client, for example, you know, that one of they're younger, they're one of their primary objectives is, you know, they tell you that they want to save for a home, their first home. FHSA has to be number one priority as opposed to RSP. You're going to get your tax deduction regardless, which, by the way, maybe even if they're younger and have low income, you do have the flexibility to defer your deduction, right? So you can carry that forward and save it for a future year and deduct in the future if you expect your income to be higher in the future. But because of that tax deduction, I would say your FHSA would be priority number one, followed by, you know, RSP, TFSA, right? Because the FHSA has the least restrictions. Your home buyer's plan, you've got to repay it back, right? And that is a bit of a constraint for some who, you know, maybe for cash flow reasons, it's just simpler if you know the money's there to take.
And the big difference, Frank, with the new FHSA is the fact that that's deductible against income, right? Unlike the TFSA contribution where you can max fund it, but you're not getting any kind of deduction.
Exactly. You're getting that deduction because, you know, in the TFSA, you know, there's no deduction. So yes, you get the tax-free withdrawal, but you get that with the FHSA too. So in my view, the FHSA is the best of both worlds. It's taken the best elements from RSPs and the best elements from the TFSA and combined them.
So if somebody had 20,000, they made 100 grand last year, they've got 20,000, they can deploy, you're saying, all right, well, we'll max out the 8K into the FHSA, the new program. Then we're going to top up the RSP. We're going to get a refund because of the deduction against income that we can then put into the TFSA, right? So you're kind of 1, 2, 3, having them all aligned.
That's right.
That's right. Unless you don't want to buy a house.
Whoa.
Well, hey, even if you're just, if you don't want to buy the house, let's say that was the case, then the contribution would go RSP, TFSA, right? And you've got the flexibility to change your mind and go, okay, I can use the RSP money to pull out and buy a home, and the TFSA money I can use to do anything I want.
Yeah, but even the FHSA, even if you don't buy a house, you're taxed on it. But what's the tax consequences on it? Because you're still enjoying tax-free growth for those years, right?
Well, you'd be taxed on the growth, right, at the end of the day. Am I right, Frank? So basically your own capital could be pulled out. But any growth on the money would be then taxed at your marginal tax rate.
So would that be more advantageous then than the RRSP?
No.
It wouldn't be any.
It all depends on your tax bracket, right?
Yeah.
Well, you get your deduction for putting it in, because when you pull out your RRSP, you got to pay your taxes as well, right?
Well, I think you've got a good point. I think you want to do both. Odds are, you know, if you're so young, you're not sure whether you want to buy eventually you're probably going to want to buy your first home. So you want to be thinking about getting every advantage that CRA is going to give you. So top making those RSP contributions. Now this new first time home buyers, your TFSA yep. option. Those are your three buckets you want to get filled, right? And you want to start early, stay committed, stay invested, and then make smart decisions later with what you've done in way of long-term planning.
Well, and that's the thing.
My concerns,
what you want to do
my
is
concern it, stems it all, from it. Go ahead, Brad.
Yeah. Well, no, I might be answering your question. So basically, it all depends on someone's tax bracket, right? There's no like anyone in their 20s, unless you're making well over $70,000 a year. This is a general rule because the RSP, once you use that room, you lose it. Whereas the TFSA, you can withdraw, recontribute, and you get that amount back. And so the tax deduction, this is pre-FHSA. So with the I will always lean someone to the TFSA because, quite frankly, that is going to be the most powerful investment vehicle in Canada for retirement. I mean, it has no income test implications as of currently when it comes to OAS, GIS, anything of that nature. You get the money back. You're granted money. You don't have to earn the room. And you are keeping your RRSP open for later on in life when you do make the big bucks and you need the tax deduction. Or in some cases, I have clients who tell me, I want to buy multiple properties. Well, one's going to be a principal residence and the others are going to be they're going to be subject to capital gains. And so this gives you the ability in the RSP room to take that taxable capital component and put that into your RSP to offset the tax implications, which, I mean, I did myself, full disclosure. So it all depends. And I think the key is, and I think what we're, you know, showing here is you need, if you're, you know, 35 and under, actually at any age, but specifically looking, this is the type of talent that's out there and you have to start looking for it. You can't just be walking into a financial institution dealing with a teller, crossing your fingers and hoping it's done right. The amount of people that still come in today, the TFSA was started in 2009. The ignorance level on the TFSA is so bloody high. It's so high.
Oh, yeah, a lot of people, Brent, to getting, your point, people think it's an account you can only get at the bank in some cases. That
thank
it's
you.
Some sort of just savings account that you can't really do any effective long-term investing and saving. Nothing could be further right from the truth. So, yeah,
you can basically like it's just insanity. I wish I had the TFSA when I was younger because I wouldn't have had to do the home buyer's withdrawal and pay it all back every year. And then of course you have to pay the minimum back. And then if you don't, they tax you on it. And of course, that's probably going to happen in a year that you make a good bonus and then you're at a higher tax rate. Like it's just, there's a lot of implications if it's not done right.
See, I think the important part is when people are looking to buy or thinking about it, like a lot of times I'll send people to Trevor and they're thinking about doing it a year from now. So those people that have that foresight to do that can really take advantage of that. The people that are saying, I want to buy a house that I just saw in the news, well, not the newspaper, but on Facebook the other day, and they want to do it right away. They don't have that opportunity to do that, right?
Hey, but smart planning begets flexibility, right? I think Brandon's point is a good one. That TFSA is an amazing tool. Didn't exist when we were all young. You guys are younger than I am, but like when we were super early, I look at my kids. I've got a 20-year-old and a 22-year-old. They've maxed out their TFSAs. They're doing lots of investing and long-term thinking in those vehicles. And those dollars can be used for anything, buying homes, buying cars, setting up a business, whatever you want. I think it's the greatest innovation that from a savings perspective that CRA has put in place maybe ever.
That HFSA is pretty good though. That's interesting. I like that.
Yeah, definitely, for sure. And helps address this issue around affordability, right? Like even just to get the down payment for a house these days, given housing prices and the escalation and inflation we've seen, you've got to have a lot of money, right? Yeah. Hundreds of thousands in many cases.
So. And I think priority one should be subscribing to Professional Insight. That should be the number one. We'll circle around here.
Yeah, getting professional help is something we're very much in favor of.
Well, I mean, I think the consensus is that tax rules don't get easier. They become more complicated. There's more options. And everything is so circumstantial that, you know, it's hard to say, here's what you should do. Generally speaking, it really is so dependent on everybody's personal situation, right? So, yeah, there's going to be a general hierarchy of how to do things, but everybody's situation is going to be different. So, you know, younger folks who are going to be in the market for their first home, that's really the target for this new FHSA. And so you're right, Brandon. I wish too that the TFSAs were available when we were younger and coming out of university and started, you know, saving money. But the youth today have much more options available to them and increases complexity, which just means that the greater need to work with guys like you to figure it all out for them.
A couple of things that I wanted to say was where I was going at before Brandon had spoke was, I'm not sure where, sorry, Jeff, the future is going with respect to this newer generation in terms of renting versus buying houses. That's what I was going to allude to. And the second thing was, in terms of first-time home buyers, it's different in the legal sphere because you cannot have owned a prior home anywhere in the world, and you could not have, your spouse could not have owned a home in order for you to qualify for the first-time home buyer exemption for land transfer tax.
Josh, those are great points. Like, I'm thinking the same thing. The youth today might go, hey, housing market's so bloody expensive, I'm not even thinking about it. I'm going to rent. I'm going to do what I do. I'm going to put money behind a business or something different. So
even in that case, though, so as you know, as one in the tax sphere, I mean, the one thing we do anytime rules come out is, how do you figure out how do you get around them? How do you kind of manipulate them, take them advantage of it, right?
Plan.
And do it for as long as you, yeah, you plan. So one of the things, by the way, one of the things I think that sort of created an opportunity, let's say you have clients, younger clients who may tell you, you know, I don't ever plan to, I'm going to rent. I just think that's going to make sense. They're more mobile. They don't know where they're going to be in the future. So they're going to plan to rent. So these new FHSA rules, you know, you qualify as long as you meet the criteria. So, you know, let's say a client meets the criteria, but has no desire to purchase a home. I mean, they could still utilize this FHSA, take advantage of $40,000 of contribution room over their lifetime. And if down the road, you know, they continue to have that mindset that they're never going to purchase, well, when down the road, let's say 15 years out, you know, comes time, they've got to close this, they do have options. And one of the options, at least from my understanding of the review of the legislation, is that they'll be able to transfer that money to their RSP, to their RSPs, without requiring any RSP contribution room, right? And then you'll be able to,
awesome.
You'll be able, that would you'll be able to, yeah. So you'll, and you'll be able to do that as long as you continue to qualify as a first-time home buyer. So, you know, for me, that seems to signal, look, if you have folks who have no desire, well, they can still utilize this plan and in a sense, get an additional $40,000 of RSP contribution room over and above their regular RSP limits. At least that's my assessment of these new rules as they're laid out right now.
Hey, that's a game changer, Frank. I love that.
100%.
Yeah. That's tilts it. Yeah,
see, I find it interesting because I find younger and younger people are looking to buy now. I think they're just more educated and they have people in their family that are talking to them about it. So, like, I just sent Trevor someone 18 who just literally turned 18. He's like, I need to plan now how to get in the house.
But they need support. They need strong support, Jeff. It's very smart.
Well, they need insight and they need people to have those conversations with them, which other people might not have, right? But, you know, for real estate, it's great to have the renters because the renters pay the other people's mortgages. So they're making other people money, right? So it's...
Your kids are going to be okay because you're in the game, though, and you know, right? Brandon, same, right? Like everybody on here, same, right? Because you're paying attention to the appropriate things, and hopefully our audience as well now, right, gets the opportunity to have this insight and take advantage of these things.
I love it. Hey, boys, what do you say we shift gears? We're going to be okay. I want to talk about retirement. I'm looking at the clock. And I want to make sure we get a chance to squeeze this in.
That's a great segue because this actually all ties in, right? From a nice segue.
He's looking for your job there, Curry. He's looking for your job. He's taking the host.
No, good. That's fine.
I do tons of hosting right from here. I'm accustomed to managing managers, PMs going, okay, great point. Let's move on.
Yeah. So the market basically for 2023. So Mike, this is over to you, and then this will go, this is going to basically lead into like the order of asset withdrawal too, is what I want. So let's start with what's your assessment, and because you've interviewed, I think in the last week or and a half or so, about 10 portfolio managers or so, something like that. I saw on the channel. Yeah.
100%.
And what are they saying? So go ahead. What's 2023 going to look like?
Monday of this week, we actually broadcast on Tuesday our 2023 market outlook. So I had a chance to sit down with our two CIOs, Leslie Marks, CIO for equity, Steve Locke, our CIO for fixed income, Ron Hansen, one of our experts on macroeconomic threats and so forth. The short story, 2022 was horrendous. It was awful, right? From a total return perspective, most indices were negative. Interest rates went up big, bonds lost, equities lost. Your typical balanced fund was down 10 to 15%. It was a pretty bad year across the board. 2023 is shaping up, in their words, to be better. And I'll steal this from Leslie Marks. Her point was, hey, we're cautiously optimistic about 2023. We're hopeful of a soft landing in the economy, one that avoids a devastating recession where we see lots of job loss and tremendous amount of pain. We're hoping for that balancing act, the Goldilocks approach. And so better certainly for fixed income. We had rate hikes in 2022 to stave off inflation. Inflation's running hot. Jerome Powell, Fed chair, is committed to breaking the back of this inflationary issue. So they're committed to higher for longer. So people got to be prepared for that. It's going to be more expensive to finance things, cars and homes and the stuff they want to own. It's also going to be more costly for those that want to borrow to invest or speculate. So tighter financial conditions are going to persist, but it sets up well for total return in bond land, in the bond market, the fixed income market, according to Steve Locke. He sees positive returns in bond portfolios in the mid single digits to high single digits, depending on your asset mix. And that the second half from an equity perspective is shaping up to be much better. The first half, I think there's going to be a lot of debate and look at the statistics and the earnings numbers. Like today, bank earnings came out. They weren't in the US, not what the industry was looking for. So banks have sold off, looked like the market was down a bit. You're going to see a bunch of that where earnings get announced and we're going to get a chance to digest the road forward. The second half of this year from an equity perspective looks brighter, right? That if we avert recession and are able to stabilize earnings and continue to get things growing, we should see some decent numbers put up across the board. We have an overweight for Canada, an underweight for US, a positive outlook for international. The US we're a little concerned about because of its propensity and focus on growth names. A lot of the big tech leaders are in the US, and with interest rate increases, tech has sold off dramatically, some of the more growthy segments of the market, in favor of a rotation into value, right? So banks, some of the cyclicals, energy stocks, and so forth that Canada's quite rich in. So we like the Canadian story. We think the US dollar's probably going to weaken a little bit, which could be good for emerging markets and some areas. Big question marks geopolitically. Certainly the Russia-Ukraine war has tossed a wrench into energy balance in Europe, and they're looking for ways to figure that out, as is the rest of the world. Canada's energy rich, so that in some ways is positive for us. The other big geopolitical question mark is China. What happens there? They've gone from a zero COVID policy, lockdowns everywhere, to suddenly everything's open. Just go. We're gonna let everybody get COVID. we're gonna see what happens. And it's kind of the way a lot of people wanted the North American solution to look, right? There were those who fought lockdowns and stay at home and all the rest of it. They said, listen, just let this thing run its course. We'll see what happens.
A Florida solution.
You run the risk, right, guys, of of hospitals being overwhelmed, people dying in droves. So we'll see. But, you know, I was on a call. One of the participants, Brandon, the people I interviewed, was our folks at China Asset Management from Beijing. And Wenji Ding was on with me, and she said, yeah, everybody's got COVID right now. Everybody. I had it 2 weeks ago. The entire office has had it. It is sweeping. So who knows? Maybe it washes through the entire economy rather quickly, and suddenly they've got herd immunity and they experience a better, faster recovery. We'll see. But they loom big on the world stage. You know, issues around Taiwan are completely different. But, you know, there's no shortage of things to worry about. But long-term optimism means diversification, means sticking with a strategy that's value-based and has some ability to participate in a variety of different elements of growth. And we see 23 shaping up better than 22. That was a difficult time.
Did
now,
you
on that point? Oh, go ahead, Bondo.
Sorry, I was just going to say, being a geologist or a former interest in geologist, did you what do you think about that new find in Sweden with the deposit of rare earth metals?
Well,
have you
that's
heard about that?
I hadn't heard specifically about that one, but the whole rare earth metals issue, mm-hmm. I know China has a lock hold on that market.
Well, now Sweden just found a good deposit.
So Josh, you bring up a great point, and I love it. One of the managers I interviewed on Tuesday was Benoit Gervais. He's our resource manager, right? And so he runs our precious metals fund. He runs our global resource product. And I said on the call, this whole commodity story is one people continue to get wrong. I think in many ways, you know, the oil producers and some of the, you know, the base metals commodity people have been kind of lumped into the offenders camp that they're contributing to CO2 emissions. They're dirtying the world. You know, they're a problem we need to fix. His point is the way forward to a green economy, right, is utilizing commodities, whether it's, you know, gold, oil, precious metals, gas, rare earth elements. Like, we're going to need all these things, and we're going to need to use them smart. The other thing I'm sort of struck with now from a global investment perspective is the fact that if you're looking through this ESG lens, right, long-term sustainability, CO2 emissions, and our future, you know, the future of humanity, it involves commodities, right? It involves, you know, oil and gas as transitional fuels till we get mm-hmm. to more sustainable renewables. It means tremendous amount of investment in everything we do. Everything as humanity needs to be redesigned through that type of lens. So, hey, if I was heading to school today, if I was graduating from high school, I think maybe I'd want to be an engineer, because there's a tremendous amount of opportunity to redesign everything we're about. I also
that should be a game changer on the global scale, though, right? Because Europe so reliant on these rare metals, so reliant on China for these rare metals, that they're no longer going to have to rely on China, right? Which is,
well, yeah, Josh, you hit it
for that aspect of it.
Resource scarcity is a major issue. A secure source of whatever resource you're looking for, whether that's gas or oil or rare earth metals or
water,
you name
eventually.
It, you got to know where you can get it from, and you got to be able to depend on who you're getting it from. So, yeah, I think having that come from Sweden or Canada or other friendly hands is a great place to go.
Well, it goes to say, because just recently Tesla just slashed their prices by 20%. They're having huge supply chain issues out of China. One of the things that you're very good at is the geopolitical landscape, which I'm going to get into because I really want to tackle that. But that also bodes well, though, for domestic car manufacturers like General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler to take the lead in the EV space, because they're very close to the Ring of Fire, specifically in Northern Ontario. That supposedly is going to be on by 2027, 2028.
Hey, one thing. So, Brandon, kind of a cool sidebar story. You know, Elon's in the news pretty much every day, right? great, great background story. He's got a connection to Canada. He went to Queens at one point. He was actually a summer intern at Mackenzie Investments back in.
Get out.
Yeah. He was there just before me, but folks I know well knew Elon Musk as a summer employee at Mackenzie Investments. That's funny. Said he used to run around with emeralds in his pocket, raw emeralds. His dad was from South Africa, I think, and was involved in mining and so forth. And Elon was always a little unusual, clearly a genius in many ways. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Different kind of cat for sure. And you got to give him credit. He's reinventing the world, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe he's bit off more than he can chew with Twitter, but what he's doing with Tesla seems to be game changing. And I can tell you this firsthand. I signed up for Starlink, the internet solution at the cottage, because I couldn't get reliable high speed internet any other way. So now I'm paying Elon so on a monthly basis for internet.
Sir,
and how's
the internet? The internet good with Eric
or what? Oh, the internet's amazing! Like you should see the speeds on Starlink. It's incredible.
And are you seriously?
Yeah, off the charts, like faster than my high speed in the city sometimes. I was like, yeah, it was wild.
No issue.
So I'm streaming. You know, I've got, I'm up there on Zoom like this and, you know, doing meetings and doing everything I need to do where that was impossible before.
That's cool.
Now on that note, so I don't know if you follow Peter Zion. He's I guess a geopolitical researcher, scientist, and basically he's got a YouTube channel, and he touched on a couple things, and one of the things that I know that you're passionate about is the geopolitical landscape, and that is the population of Russia and the population of China being not what they are or what they are perpetuated to be, which is another reason why reason why Tesla is having a problem right now.
So I've been reading his book, The End of the World is Just the Beginning.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's right.
So I got it. I have it. It's actually I'm an Audible subscriber. Not sure if Audible contributes to this podcast webcast, but they probably should.
They should.
But anyway, yeah, The End of the World is Just the Beginning. And it's fascinating. What he's talking about, the whole trends around deglobalization, right? The fact that you've got to have secure sources for whatever you want. And odds are, if you want to do that, you better make it yourself or make it close to home or make it get a source from friendly hands. And so this is another big trend, not necessarily a good one from a price perspective. It's kind of inflationary long run in that you got to rethink what you're doing. He talks about in his book, population collapse, the opposite. Like a lot of folks think about, oh, population topped 8 billion last year. We're just going to keep on growing. He's talking about the opposite problem, that perhaps the whole thing sort of caves in on itself, that it's not.
Well, let me give you a jumping board on that. Yeah. Like, let me give you a jumping board on that one and then take it from here. China lied about about 100 million people of population size. They had the one child policy in the 90s. On top of that, they industrialized. And we know that when you industrialize, you move to urban centers and you have less kids because kids are expensive. But when you're agricultural, you have as many kids as you can because kids are free labor. So at the same time as the one child policy, China implemented and industrialized and then went more modern. They urbanized, they had less kids. And he's like saying like 10, 15 years and you're just like, they don't have traits, people. On top of that, COVID-19 clearly shed a light on all those companies that moved all their factories to China or to the Asia Pacific region on what happens if you centralize everything. And Mexico, ironically, through why Canada and the U.S. are actually sitting pretty because of our North American Free Trade Agreement or whatever Trump called it after he renegotiated
USMCA.
It. USMCA.
Was that Trevor?
It is. Yeah, that was Trevor. He spoke. It was crazy. Trevor spoke. What?
I tried speaking earlier. I realized my mic was muted when we were talking about the the Starlink. Starlink being.
Oh, did you have Starlink too, Trev? Like
I was considering getting it for my trailer because they allow you to roam with it. But I've heard a lot of complaints. People that are roaming with it, they're getting slaughtered on speeds.
What you're talking about is the RV version of Starlink. That's what I have too. I don't roam with it. I've got it as a permanent location of my cottage, but I have the RV version, partly because it's also scalable. Like you can turn it on or off whenever you want, right? So I'm only there 6 months of the year. The other six shut down, so I can just turn it off and not pay. Where the regular version, you have to. And like anything, the network of satellites that Elon is putting up continues to increase, right? You probably have seen footage of, if you haven't seen it personally, these launches that take place across the night sky. It's incredible. He's on his way to 40,000 satellites. Right now he's at, I don't know, 5 or 7.
He's going to take over the world.
He's doing some things right, but I wouldn't back away from the Starlink for a second. I think it's great. They're using it in Ukraine too, right? Like that's what's supplying the Ukrainian army with
the drones,
high-speed access when they need it. Bit of a segue.
The now,
bar there.
Yeah, no, sorry. We just Trev there for a second.
And I'm not
going to go on Starlink, go on the China route, because that's just very interesting, and how Mexico has cheaper labor than China and a more skilled labor force than China now, and their population's in great shape. So you want to take it from there, because I know that's your passion with geopolitical.
But yeah, I also want you to reconcile kind of what we're talking about. And I don't want this to come across as though I'm in any way a Trump supporter, but isn't that what Trump was kind of trying to get to? And he was definitely, his messages sometimes were sound, but his communication was just so off point. Like with his Made in America.
That seemed like blatant flag waving, right? He was going to bring back the coal industry. You're going to, he made a bunch of hollow promises for things he
clean coal.
But ideologically, though, similar, though, no, right? Like just try to make.
And this idea that, you know, the Peter Zion idea of, hey, the end of the world in its current state is really only the beginning. We got to kind of rethink what we're going to do, where we're going to do it, how we're going to do it. So onshoring those trends, or deglobalization, making things more locally, particularly those things you have to have, is only going to increase. I think everybody's attention is on that. You mentioned Musk. He's been complimented on his ability to maintain supply chain issue, whether it's microchips or, you know, rare earth elements or whatever he needs to make batteries. This guy's been able to kind of make sure he has what he needs to make the cars. Everybody's got to do that, whether it's PPE, you know, vaccines, microchips, all of it. Like, that's a big trend. So, hey, we're big believers in China. Mackenzie is an owner I think the largest asset manager in China, China Asset Management. We see that population growth and the creation and development of the middle class is a tremendous opportunity. China is a driver behind world economic growth. Their economy grows at a faster pace than anywhere else in the world. And they're a major contributor to efficiency from a manufacturing perspective. And there's lots of places around the world that can manufacture things, some cheaper, some less so, some more reliable, potentially. I think COVID sort of exposed the world to the risk of making assumptions, right? That, hey, we'll always have X. Maybe you won't. Maybe you need to figure out what you do if you don't, right? So, yeah, there's all geopolitical risk is something I think you got to think about as a financial advisor, as an investor. Where and how much you deploy in certain areas needs to be top of mind. My view is an optimistic one, that the world hopefully will be a safer, better place in the future as it is today versus where it was in the past, and that we continue to innovate. And there's always going to be political tension. Sure. We don't need, you know, actual shooting wars, hopefully, to resolve some of these issues.
So the diversification piece is what are you starting to see companies move that way and have multiple sites you know, throughout because of the deglobalization that's taken place? Is that, do you think that's a trend that's going to continue to happen?
Sure. I think, well, think about it, Brandon, the world's aware now of their risk profile. A bunch of things happened that we didn't think could happen, which disrupted the ability to get the stuff we need when we need it. And hey, that just says maybe I wasn't as aware of some of the outlier risks, those Six Sigma things that you think can never happen, sometimes do. And maybe you want to be aware. And that, you know, sound investment philosophy means diversifying, buying quality, diversifying, not putting too many eggs in one basket, but also understanding your own strengths and weaknesses. You can't be pulling your money in and out all the time. I think you want to have a well-defined course of action, align yourself with pros who know what they're doing, and think long-term. And all of the managers I've interviewed in the last 10 days, that came up. Geopolitical risk. What are you doing about it? How do you limit? And they do that with position sizes. They do that with you know, diverse geographic and sector-based diversification strategies. There's lots of ways that professional asset management can help protect your long-term saving strategy.
Now, you, with that and proper PMs managing the money, and absolutely. I mean, I was having this conversation literally last night on the difference between, for example, an ETF and a mutual fund. And Mackenzie does both. Mm-hmm. But the fact that mutual funds, you have that ability to own puts, calls, options. You can have a cash wedge within there. So it gives you a lot more flexibility, whereas ETF, you have to be fully vested and you have to follow the index that you're trying to mimic. But on that case, you've also mentioned, and you're very knowledgeable in the order of asset withdrawal, which is something that as a financial planner, I get asked quite a bit. Do I defer my tax liability? And, you know, Frank, feel free to chime in here as well. You know, later on in life, or do I kill the RSP now and just let the TFSA go? Or,
well, hey, so Brandon, this is a great topic, and one I'm glad we've got a chance to chat about. So let me set the stage for you a little bit on why Mackenzie and Frank and I have been working together on a project for the last couple of years related to retirement, right? So, but I'll fill you in on kind of why we think it's critically important. Let me give you the background stats. I love it in the big wide shot with everybody there, so I can kind of see who's doing what, but not that I'm trying to direct.
Hey, Rook, can we go to that? That'd be great if we could.
Because I think I want everybody to jump in here. I've got a few questions for you guys, the panel, that I want to direct to you. So anyway, so the big crux of it, when we, you know, Mackenzie's an asset manager. When we look at the landscape of investment options in Canada, where do we see the bulk of the dollars residing? It's in Canadian 60 plus, right? It's people on the verge of retirement who are saving for retirement. Right now in Canada, there's somewhere north of 6 million of us. I'm not quite there yet, but that are 60 plus, right? Those 6 million plus Canadians control upwards of $3.5 trillion, boys, with a T, dollars assets. That's like 2/3 of investable wealth. And a lot of them are focused on this problem, this, hey, I'm going to be retiring soon. And what do you think, here's my question to you. What do you think the number one question on their mind is?
Do enough.
Will I outlive my money?
Bingo. Yep. They're both those. Yep. Do I have enough? They're worried about running out of money, right? So, you know, their big question is, hey, am I going to be okay? Do I have enough? How much can I get? How long is it going to last? How much tax am I going to pay? What's my estate plan if I have one? Most people haven't done the soup to nuts on that. That's exactly what our good friend Frank DiPietro and I have spent the last couple of years thinking about. We work with independent financial advisors to help them make smart decisions. And one of these decisions is the focus on retirement planning. And we as an industry, Brandon, you've seen it. We've been great at the accumulation story. Remember what I said at the beginning, when I started, there was 25 billion in funds and ETFs didn't exist. Wind the clock ahead, there's 2 trillion in funds and ETFs. Like, it's amazing, the growth. So, hey, we as a business, as an industry, as Canadians have been pretty good at putting money away. That's great. But we still have a lot of doubt about the end answer. Hey, am I going to be okay? Do I have the wherewithal to do what I want to do in retirement and to make that transition? And it's partly because we, and I'll consider Mackenzie as guilty at this as anybody, tend to get all caught up in the idea of talking about product fees and performance. So we manage mutual funds and ETFs. We charge a fee. We generate performance numbers. So we love to talk about those things. But at the end of the day, the real work is done at the client level, right? Putting together the plans that help people understand they're going to be all right. And that's what Frank and I've done. And I was shocked to learn, and this is something I take away from Frank, is that, you know, the way you approach your withdrawal strategy in retirement, this idea you hit on, the order of asset withdrawal, can and does have a major influence on the amount of tax you're going to pay, either now or at the estate level later on. And boys, let's face it, the single largest expense we will all endure as Canadians is taxation, bar none. So if you're not thinking with someone skilled like Frank DiPietro in your pocket, you're missing something, because you're going to wind up paying more. So Frank, maybe enlighten the guys and those on the line about some of the work on order of asset withdrawal that we've done and how that kind of funnels into this, our ability to help people understand, hey, am I going to be okay?
Sure. It is a great topic. And it's, I think, one of the biggest concerns and mysteries that retirees face going into retirement. The last 15 years in this role at Mackenzie, I can tell you the number of times I've had conversations with financial advisors about, hey, here's my client scenario. They want to know what's the best way to take money in retirement. And really, up until the last couple of years, it's been more theoretical in trying to understand how to do that. Right? So you kind of take a client situation and you try to articulate theoretically what might make sense. But at the end of the day, you really run the numbers and have really good software kind of articulate what might be the best route to go. But to Mike's point, Canadians have a number of different buckets that they may have accumulated in their life that will contribute to their income in retirement. For many, you know, who may have been fortunate enough to work at a company where you've set aside a company-defined pension plan, they have a little less to worry about. They're going into retirement saying, here's how much has been promised to me. Here's what I've got. I'm going to go with that. But that's becoming fewer and less available to most, right? Most Canadians these days are entering retirement, or facing retirement. AI, they're not having that, or having to fund their retirement from a number of sources. And that could be, you know, from their RSP. It could be from their tax-free accounts. It could from other personal savings. If they're a business owner, have a corporation, they could be drawing from their corporation. Maybe they've got rental properties, and that's going to contribute. So there's literally, you know, potentially a dozen different sources, and you want to figure out, how am I going to make up that income, that paycheck in retirement, and what's the best way to do it, right? And a study that Mackenzie ran last year found that only 22%, or put it the other way, actually 66% of Canadians are not comfortable or not confident where money's going to come from. So that's one of the big concerns. Where's it going to come from? So the work that Mike and I have been doing over the last year and a half, close to 2 years now, is really trying to articulate to clients what might be the best route, given their situation, what might be the best course of action or optimal strategy to draw down in retirement. Do I draw down from RSPs first? Do I not? You know, like, we've done RSPs, everything in financial planning that you learn when you're going through this industry is that you always defer test to the end, right? Like, defer, because the tax.
Yeah, what's the number one rule, Frank? The number one rule has always been, hey, tax paid tomorrow is better than tax paid today.
Exactly. So and that would lead you to believe that you should always just leave your money in RSP and RIFs as long as possible. And so if you're creating an income plan, then you'd really what that would tell you is take the least amount out of those plans and fund retirement with other sources if you can. But what we find is that potentially exposes Canadians to a very large potential tax liability when they die, right? Because as you may know, when we pass, in most scenarios, clients are going to lose up to half of what they've accumulated in their RSPs and RIF. And so from a financial planning perspective, compared to other possible withdrawal strategies, that may actually end up being the worst scenario. So how do you assess whether it makes sense to take more money out of your RSPs in retirement, potentially pay some tax along the way so that you reduce this potential hit for your estate? And so the work that Mike and I have been doing is about assessing different withdrawal strategies, right? Taking a client's scenario, taking a look at all those various sources of income that are available to them in retirement, the savings that they accumulated, and saying, comparing and contrasting different withdrawal strategies for the end client, and making a recommendation on what might be the optimal way to draw income in retirement. Because what might be good for me may not necessarily be good for Josh or for Trevor, for anyone on here. So every client, again, is different. And this whole idea of how you draw down makes a very big difference in the amount of tax and your net estate values and all those things that are so important to clients.
You're going to be busy with that. You're going to be busy, right?
Huge. Frank and I have worked with advisors from across the country to sort of consult in a way on some of these more complicated cases. And I know we've worked with business owners, and some of the most challenging, Frank, we found are the areas where you could almost do anything, right? So if you've got a lot of corporate assets, you know, your RSP and your TFSA and your open account are one thing, but the corporate assets, there's a lot of flexibility and nuance, almost artsmanship, you know, artistic creativity and how you want to approach this.
I love this approach.
And that's what I consider Frank an artist, honestly, in understanding and articulating these tax concepts. We've seen where the difference between strategies on the same case set of facts, you got, you know, a couple, business owner, all of those assets we talked about, just a difference in order of asset withdrawal could make as much as $500,000 difference in taxes payable, right? So crazy. Getting the order of asset withdrawal right is critical. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily intuitive. It can change case by case and situation by situation, certainly. So there isn't just one way to do it. And we think you got to get it right. And we love, you know, our ability to help nail down the you know, discuss options, look at ways to effectively address some of these tax concerns.
Oh, it's a great holistic approach, right?
Guys, this whole thing about retirement, honestly, is so deep. Like Mackenzie spent a bunch of time asking questions, running surveys, discussing with Canadians who are either in retirement or, you know, going, you know, headed for retirement. And they're concerned with a lot of stuff, right? The big six for us. And I'll tell you sort of, I think we got to come back at this at some point on a future show and talk about, you know, personal happiness in retirement. What does that take? It's not just money, right? It's so personal happiness is determined by a bunch of different things and how you address not just the dollar figures to fund what you want to do, but hey, how are you spending your time? Are you giving back? What are you doing? So this personal checklist on retirement. But Canadians are concerned about that idea of purposeful retirement. Hey, a lot of us create our identities through what we do, right? We identify our value as a person is associated with who we are, what we are. And suddenly, oh, I no longer do that. Does that mean I'm worthless, right?
Well, a piece of you dies, right?
Yeah, in a way. I think it's a transformational. Frank and I found that this is a transitional time, a time of adjustment, a time of a lot of different types of stresses, right? People, as they go through or into or think about retirement, have a lot, you know, there's a, what Larry DiStilio, one of our partners, talks about, it's a sort of a stress inventory. There's a bunch of different stresses. So, you know, it can be financial stress for sure. Your personal happiness stress inventory, like what's going to make you happy? What do you really want to do? How are you going to spend your time? Your unique skill set. How can you turn your unique skill sets into effective ways of both spending time, perhaps earning money, staying engaged, staying young, using your brain, right? There's so much that goes into the process. But, you know, a lot of people are worried. You know, that big one you guys talked about, you know, am I going to run out of money, is kind of number one. And that's number one for people both in retirement today and headed for retirement tomorrow. They don't know whether what they have is enough. And Canadians have been pretty good at, you know, working hard, saving, paying down debt, accumulating capital in all of the pools that we talked about. But they still don't know whether it adds up to the right number. And working with a professional advisor, we feel, is critical in putting together the knowledge that you're going to be okay. And just having that is a great stress reliever in itself. Frank, tell the story. I don't know whether you want to tell a story about your in-laws, but it's one that I tell a lot and that I love, right? They might not like it shared, but I think it's kind of cool.
Yeah, but I think before we even get to that, just to kind of tag on to what you're saying, you know, one of the questions we go through, obviously one of the things you need to know when you're doing your retirement income plan, how much income do you need in retirement? But going on this, non-financial component of retirement, it's so overlooked sometimes, but so critical to the process, because
it's huge.
You know, Larry would say, like, how do you know how much you need without knowing exactly what you're going to do in retirement? Like, how are you going to spend your
time? Or what makes you happy?
Or what makes you happy? That will define what you're going to need, right?
Yeah, 100%.
So sometimes we look at it, the financial first, but really, it should be the other way around. The non-financial will help determine what the financial side of it is. But, from a personal perspective, my in-laws, without really getting into all of the details, my father-in-law has since passed, but when he was alive, you know, he was more of a free spirit. Worked for the Ontario Ministry of Transportation, retired a number of years ago, has a great pension plan.
Yeah, he's got the DB plan, right?
But on top of that, him and his wife, my mother-in-law, were great savers, right? So they had accumulated some wealth in their RSPs and TFS, max out TFS. So financially, they were set and have very, limited needs from a income perspective. And so when they're doing their income planning and he was fine. He never had any concerns. But my mother-in-law, on the other hand, was not a fear, more very, very conservative. And I learned in this process, she was that, client that you kind of talk about all the time, that actually, like, goes online every day and checks more statements, right? And tracks every day and would write it in a notepad what the markets are, right? She was.
Oh, Jesus.
Literally.
And so wow.
He was that conservative about, and she would track every penny that she spent, and was very concerned. She worked for Life Labs, but as part of a reorganization, she got packaged out. So she was forced into retirement, which I think added to her stress levels. In any event, these very deep concerns about, am I or are we going to be okay, right? And so through this process that Mike and I have sort of created, I put her through this process to try to ease her mind, right? And we ran through the process and we said, look, here's what you need. Here's what your assets, with some assumptions, of course, can sustain over time, And she looked at it and was absolutely blown away to know.
Hey, Frank, what was her first response?
Well, her first response was, that can't be right.
I know. So you're lying.
That's wrong. Yeah, that software you're using, it's wrong.
No good. Right? No good.
I had to literally walk through kind of the income components, where the sources were mm-hmm. coming from, how she was going to do it. And by the end of this sort of, I call it a meeting, but it was, you know, my mother-in-law over at the house. The stress off of her shoulders, I could sense it. And she was like, oh my God, like that feels great. So I think part of this process is, you know, to kind of help ease the minds of some, because sometimes you think, are we going to be okay? But on the flip side, you know, when she was telling me what her income needs were, they were really low. And I say, look, do you want to travel more in retirement? Yes, I'd love to go back to, you know, to go out east more often to see family. I just never thought I could afford it. So it's like, okay, well, you say your income need is, let's say it was $40,000. You can spend $80,000 need to. Like, don't be so conservative and enjoy your life, right? Like,
so guys, there's the key.
So that's the example, friends. Kind of taking it the other way, saying, look, you think you have to live this way, but you can actually afford much more. Don't worry about
the better lifestyle.
And there's so many people, guys, that are in that position, Canadians that are far better off than they realize, that have kind of got themselves into this poverty mindset where they go, I can't spend a nickel. You were saying things like she was shopping at the dollar store. She wouldn't do anything for herself. She was like, it was affecting her sleep. She was losing sleep. Yet at the end of the day, when you actually run the numbers, she's fine. You're going to be okay. In fact, you're better off than you know and understand. And I would say there's many Canadians that are in that camp that carry an unnecessary level of anxiety because they haven't put all the pieces together. And what we want to do is help people understand more clearly exactly what that means. And sometimes, you know, we've worked on cases where, okay, they're looking to validate $100,000 a year in net after-tax income, and the facts as stated only work out to 80, right? So, hey, there's a negative deficit. Let's examine the case. Let's talk about actual needs. Let's run the numbers. And we're able to find the right balancing point, right? And there's lots of different strategies to do that. But I would say as a whole, there's a lot to be gained by seeking professional financial advice and running the numbers. So many Canadians, men are guilty of this, right? Like, hey, we feel a pain. We don't go to the doctor. We rub some dirt on it and hope it goes away, right? And that isn't the answer, right? You want to get the right help. And understanding the scope of your situation and what you have to deal with is a big part of the process. So don't fear it, welcome it. And, you know, we see a tremendous amount of opportunity to help people reduce their stress, increase their enjoyment of this next segment of life. The big piece that everybody should take away is that people are living longer every decade, right? And that it's highly probable that us folks on the line, those listening, are going to spend more time in retirement than we spend working, right? This is a big chunk of life. So let's make sure we get it right and are prepared to enjoy this major segment of our existence on this planet.
Love it.
You know, it is actually, and as a, you know, this is a nice way to kind of put a bow tie on everything that we've discussed. I guess, you know, anyone that's listening, watching, deal with a professional now. Like, do it now. Don't walk into an office at 55 and going, oh, I think I'm going to be ready to retire. I got, you know, 5 years left. Because sometimes you can't, that's like turning the Titanic. And you can't.
But it doesn't mean you have to act right now, right? It doesn't mean that you have to act, but at least gain the knowledge.
Right.
About whether you
should. Like, I mean, because you could be stressing and not living your life when you have your health. And because you're worried about, you know, different components, like, you know, Frank's mother-in-law, and, you know, think of all the trips she never took and the family she never got to see. But if you deal with a professional right from the beginning and look at, you know, succession planning and stuff and companies that where do I put my money? You know, it's not as bad as what you might think it is. But then this is also to the people who haven't saved enough. Start early.
Best piece of advice for retirees is, hey, 30 years ago, maximize all your contributions.
Yeah.
Well, you can't do that. Right. Okay, well, what are we going to do today? And advice for folks on the line, like they might look at the last year and say, oh, returns are horrible, things bad, I don't want to make an investment. Well, I can tell you this, that's exactly the right time to be putting money to work. When markets are down and prices are low and opportunities are great, our managers are doing their best work in identifying great value opportunities. The long-term, the biggest influence on the long-term rate of return of anything you buy is the price you pay for it. The lower the price, the better your compounded return over time. There's some great value in the market today, more so than we've seen in a very long time. So use this to your advantage. Simple, easy strategies for the average saver or someone in retirement. Again, people are going to be in retirement a long time, so 25, 30 years or more. That's a long-term time frame. You can't be sitting in cash. You got to be invested. Probably a good idea to bucket sources of your money, short-term money, medium-term money, long-term money. But you want to stay invested. And use dollar cost averaging or from an accumulation perspective when you're putting money in, just do it every month. Don't time it. Don't try to figure it out. You can't figure it out. I can't figure it out. Warren Buffett can't figure it out, right? Get invested, stay invested. Dollar cost averaging when you can, buy quality. You know, don't get all worried when the headlines are bad. Oftentimes when the headlines are their worst, that's when you want to make a purchase of something effectively. So there's lots you can do to confront, but the best thing you can do is educate yourself, work with professionals, continue to, you know, to formulate an effective strategy and stick with it. Right.
Totally agree. Could not agree more. When things are on sale in the real world, you buy it. But when the investments are on sale, guess what, guys? 2022 was a fire sale. It's 25% off right now on average. So buy now, because that upswing is going to be really good when Mike said, H2 of this year, you're going to starting to see the dividends and start to see the fruits of your labor.
Yeah, look at opportunities in energy. Oil prices were negative less than 3 years ago. And
absolutely.
Guess who's making a bunch of money now? Energy companies.
Mm-hmm. Now we're gonna take the last 15 minutes of the show with both Frank and Michael on. If you guys both have time, you guys are scheduled a bit.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. So, Trev, do you got anything interesting coming down the pipeline that you want to maybe bring up? Maybe something on a future episode. Take a couple minutes and.
Well, honestly, the real hot topic right now is with labor markets and the performance of December.
Yep. Oh, I hear the music in the back. Right.
What's that?
Got the sexy music.
Oh, the music. next Bank of Canada meeting is January 25th, 10 a.m. And high likelihood that we're going to see another quarter point bump.
I say we stay flush.
Higher for longer, boys. Higher for longer.
I say we stay flush.
You think so?
Right.
Yep.
I hope so. I'm not hopefully optimistic given the 400 basis points that we had increased through 2022.
Hey, according to our fixed income managers, by the way, a lot of the price change. You know, there may still be interest rates yet to come, interest rate increases by central banks yet to come, but a lot of it's already priced in the market. So it's already in the price of the bonds themselves. Yes. So bonds are offering better opportunities for purchase than ever.
Now, well, I'll go to me, if you don't mind,
yep.
Curry.
Just, go ahead.
I had seen advertised, and I'd like the panel kind of just comment on a 5% GIC, 1 year GIC. Now, I know, obviously, our guests are dealing mostly in mutuals and the like, but what's the advice to a client in terms of the market outlook for 2023? Let's just presume that there's a 1% or let's just say a 1.5% on the portfolio. So, really would, is the market's going to do better than 6.5% essentially?
on a long-term basis, I would say it is. So a lot of folks would tend to get scared into a GIC type investment, right? Not necessarily seeing it as an investment opportunity, but going, oh, yeah, the overall market's negative. Finally, I'm getting a decent yield on a GIC. I'll buy that.
Because it's guaranteed, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. And in most cases, you're guaranteed to actually lose money on a real return basis. So the better, you know, hey, good news. Maybe your deposit assets, your short-term money are going to make a bit of a yield. Okay, fine. But your real investment money needs to find a better home. And I think markets like the one we're in set up that investment strategy. So don't get scared into going, markets are, people tend to overemphasize the recent past. So whatever just happened, they think is always going to happen. Equity markets are down, bond markets are down. I guess they'll always be that way. No, they won't. So they buy the GIC. And then 5 years from now, they look back and go, I got locked into that 5% GIC and
should have never bought
it. I would have done way better had I put my money to work in real companies. So, hey, balance makes sense. I don't think there's any need for you to go all one way or the other. Find the mix in assets that makes you comfortable. But again, crisis is typically opportunity when it comes to an equity investment strategy. And if you're just like 40 or below, zero fixed income, you know, get invested in a diverse range of global leaders, companies, and keep putting money away.
Perfect. I just wanted that on the, you know, because a lot of people are thinking that right now because they're seeing 5%, right? So, you know, the less savvy investor is thinking, okay, I'm scared. What's going on? Just as you said, right? So
yeah, the fear-based advice is to reaction.
Yep. Yeah, 100%.
Collins, anything?
Yeah, just kind of comment on the real estate market and the build market right now. It looks like 2023 has gotten off to a crawl of a start right now. I think people are kind of sitting back and waiting to see what the Bank of Canada is going to do at the end of the month. It's interesting times right now because all the builders are sitting there with still materials rising and people are waiting to buy on new builds, but the materials are continuing to go up. They're not really coming back down. So it puts some of the builders into a sticky situation because they either have to sit pat and hold off and see if the market turns, sell off a little bit lower than they're expecting. So right now, Roy LePage has predicted that it's going to be potentially still a small adjustment downwards in prices, not much. And then we should be picking up at the end of the year. So 2023 is kind of sitting there in standstill mode right now for real estate as they're all sitting back watching to see what will happen with the market. Hopefully it picks up a little bit. What tends to happen right now is the snow hits real quick around Niagara near the end of January or February. It kind of pauses until that's gone. But there's signs of buyers out there. They're just not pulling triggers. So it's an interesting start to 2023.
We had a builder, Jeff. We had a client who was buying off a builder where the builder said they tried to rely on COVID for an unforeseen delay at this point in time and tried to bump the closing to like the 2026.
Well, yeah, COVID, they've got some protection in there for builders. I think it's more towards material costs that have not come down at all. But depending, it's probably on a condo, I'd imagine, right? Because as a detached build, you can't push it out that far, I don't believe.
I don't know that they're permitted to push it out that far, Jeff, but that's why...
Yeah, well,
we're flipping the rocks, right?
There's two things happening here, and you saw that recently where I had a close last week, and the buyer had a little bit of remorse, I think, at the very end and looked for a little bit of a refund at the end, and you and John held firm, and they couldn't do nothing. But you'll see that's quite a bit in the news right now where you'll have buyers who have bought 2, 3, 4, 5 months ago, and now they're closing, the market's down quite a bit since then, and they're trying to get out, and it just doesn't happen, so... Breaches are up quite a bit right now in real estate and people are trying to get out, but you got a binding contract in Ontario. It's not as easy as people think. That should be a whole nother topic where we could get Brad on there too. We talked about that, but that's an interesting
topic. Hey, Jeff, what about that news headline? We heard of houses being sold without the owner's knowledge. That's more
fraud and all that. I think Trevor kind of deals with that more of that, right? Where people, especially when they don't have anything against their house, right? That's where people try to sell that stuff, but Yeah.
The scary part about it, there's a second one that just popped up now, but the scary part was the first story, the couple was away on vacation. Two people came in, fake ID, convinced the realtor, the bank, and a lawyer that they were the people that owned the house. And they were able to sell the house from underneath the rightful owners. Rightful owners returned home from vacation to see somebody different in their house and different furniture and everything. So that couple was able to cash
the check. That's a quick close. Wow.
That's a quick close. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that one was sold condition-free offer.
There's so many things you can do to prevent that, though, too, right? You know, so there's a lot of...
Yeah, it's called regulation.
Yeah, well...
Knowing your
little
neighbor.
Due diligence, too, you know, from the lawyer and the real estate agent and the mortgage person.
Like, that's pathetic. I'm sorry. That there's no excuse. If I have to kill a tree to open up a tax-free savings account for $100 pack, and someone just sold a multi-million-dollar home in Toronto because they had a fake ID, that doesn't compute with me at all. To put this into perspective, I had my sister-in-law who through marriage changed her last name. That's cool. So she opened up through Mackenzie an RDSP because my niece has apraxia. So we go to open it up and we need all the SIN numbers. Right away, red flag, denied, Canada. Oh, Mackenzie catches it right away because the SIN number's correct. But my sister-in-law forgot to change her last name to her married name on her SIN. So how is it that we can't open up an RDSP when all documentation we had her married name, but her maiden name just didn't get changed on the SIN and everything got rightfully so. Mackenzie caught it, denied it, and said, okay, we need a letter of direction. You guys know the whole process. Not going to bother with you. But someone can sell a multi-million dollar home in Toronto with a fake ID? That does not make sense to me at all. That is poor due diligence. And that is...
Well, you got to look at it from a real estate point of view. Like someone comes up and you're just going to try to buy it out of the blue like that, just randomly laying down on a house and all that. Like, have a little bit of a red flag go up, you know, like do a little bit of due diligence there.
That's not right.
What I feel the scariest part of that story comes down to, there's so many people that are desperate need for business right now because of how much things have slowed down that, you know, could the realtor involved in that transaction have turned a blind eye?
Cut a corner. Maybe.
I think so. Right? No, I think that something
there's been corners cut there.
Anything's possible.
There were. Oh, yeah.
There was 100%. Corners that were cut.
If it's too good to be true, it probably is, you know? And if someone lays down like that, and did they go full price or anything like that? There's not many buyers out there paying full.
This happens, this kind of weird behavior happens a fair amount. I got a good friend of mine who's a realtor in Oakville. He said there's lots of weird stuff. You got to be on guard because there's some shady things that can occur.
Yeah.
Oh, especially right now because there are a lot of desperate realtors out there that are looking for that payday. And, you know, it's too easy. It's not happening. It's not real. There's a grind going on.
People didn't do their due diligence and they didn't do their job. And that's a shame.
It's scary.
It is. It's scary really sad. It's really scary.
What happened? Did they get their house back?
I don't know the end of the story yet.
I'm sure they did. The bank
I don't know that it's been resolved.
Well, someone's on the hook for money somewhere there, right?
So the original title insurance would probably kick in. Something. Like, they'd be insured.
There's usually a fraud protection on the title insurance policy.
Yes.
Well, someone needs to get fired, too.
What a world.
Because that's...
What a world.
Well, that agent should be on the hook for something too. That's, you know, we'll have
absolutely
insurance
that's
for that
my
too,
point.
Right?
Someone's got to do something there because, you know, there's a lot of, obviously the fraudsters need to go to jail. That couple that actually owned the house, both of them, both sets, need to be compensated in some capacity. And even the buyers, I feel bad for the buyers because I bet you unless they were part of the fraud.
As a real estate agent, you referred, like most, if you have a successful business, you referred most of it. If you're not, it's a sign call or something. Right off the bat, you got to have your guard up, you know? Like,
Toronto's
can I buy this house right here? It's, oh yeah, 100%. Well, Toronto's down here now. Let's not kid ourselves. It's very much down here.
No,
now.
No, not to the same extent. The though. It's
on
same,
a, it's on a higher bath. Scale in Toronto, but a lot of those practices have come down here.
Well, but think about it, yes. Right? Like if you're used to doing 40 transactions a year, let's say, then a new one, okay, great. You'll do a little extra due diligence. Right. Yeah. You might not have the time to do it, but you're, hey, this isn't normally how I get deals. But if you're only doing 5 transactions a year and now all of a sudden a multi-million dollar transaction comes across your desk, you know, like there in one of my private broker Facebook groups, there was another broker that posted last week, shouldn't have woken up out of bed today, lost $70,000 in commission. It's like, who counts a commission check before it closes? Right? And unfortunately, realtors, mortgage professionals, sometimes advisors, they're counting their checks before they come in.
Yeah, and it's Breachville right now, so that's a whole different podcast. We really got to do something on breaches because that's common practice right now.
Listen to Kenny Rollins, the gambler.
Stolen signs.
Our next, all of it. To everyone that's watching and listening, thanks again for taking the time. And Mike and Frank, again, thank you so much. We'll definitely love to have you
thanks
on again.
This was awesome, guys. I really enjoyed the conversation. Brandon, I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you to leave us with a Scotch recommendation. From your rail behind. What do you want listeners to try?
Which one's the emptiest? What's the emptiest one? Because that's the one you like.
I have a ton. Oh, let's see.
Oh, this is going to be a plug for his business.
That looks like an Aberlour to me.
It's either going to be a plug or it's Gretzky's.
Oh,
no, it's not. Okay.
No.
Rowan Co.
It's the truth.
Rowan Co. It's an Irish whiskey. My neighbor got me onto it. It's super smooth. Very good. And I was actually on the line with, we have a call, like an IT call center in Ireland. And we just start talking, yada, yada, yada. He's like, oh, have you ever had Roland Cole? And I said, I got it on my back bar. I love it. Definitely, something really nice. And always.
The Irish whiskeys are amazing. Easy.
Not an Irish whiskey, a Canadian whiskey.
Let's see.
Niagara Falls Craft Distillers.
There's the plug.
That's a nice bottle. That's nice bottle.
Or nice even bottle. Better. Hey, the maple whiskey.
Where's the Diablo or whatever?
Hey, Niagara Falls Craft Distillers, the maple whiskey. That one's fantastic.
The maple whiskey. Yeah, that's good too.
I know. I would have had a Lagavulin in here.
Weren't we voting on a bottle or something, Curry? Remember you had
We were, say. Yeah, the bottle design.
Yeah.
Whatever happened with that? Did that product not get out?
Yeah, it's stuck in China right now. So kind of a bit bigger. Thanks, China.
Thanks, supply chain. Appreciate that.
Thanks, supply chain. Thanks, COVID. Awesome. And just for everyone that's listening, just two quick things. Our next show is going to be on the 27th of January. So catch it when that goes. And then finally, the first ever Cryer Media event. The Ice Wine Gala, cool as ice, down in Niagara Falls at the Niagara Falls Power Station is tomorrow night at 7 p.m. Sold out. Over 750 people are in attendance. This is going to be amazing. Dean Blundell is going to be there. Chris Rook, who is our producer, Tim, is also going to be there putting this all together. It's going to be absolutely amazing. All the top chefs in Niagara, Ice Wine. Regular wine.
You going, Curry?
Scotch.
Hey?
Are you going?
Pope Catholic? Absolutely, I'm going to go.
Nice.
I love wine more than scotch. Yeah, I'd say I love wine just because it's just like, oh God, I love great wine. Great wine.
Nectar of the gods.
Anyways, Bondo, take us out.
Help us help you stay informed. Out.
Thanks, everybody.
Jeff Wood. glad that I'm shining a light on music and the rock stars who make it.
He just was one of those people. He stood out.
He was a magic guy. He really was a magic guy. We all have force. He had the same amount of force as we all have.
This was before Led Zeppelin. Robert was full on. I mean, he was Led Zeppelin without the band behind him. He had the hair, the jeans, the whole thing, you know. And he was amazing.
The Records and Rockstars podcast, heard around the world and yours to hear wherever you get podcasts. All the episodes from JeffWoodsRadio.com.
The Podcast Super Friends is a monthly meeting of five podcast producers.
Hi, I'm Catherine O'Brien from Branch Out Programs in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
I'm John Gay from Jagged Detroit Podcasts.
I'm Matt Kundle from the Sound Off Podcast Network.
I'm David Yes from Pod 617, the Boston Podcast Network.
And I'm Johnny Peterson from Straight Up Podcasts.
Together, they form the Podcast Super Friends, an alliance of podcast masterminds sharing best practices, insights, and discussions to help make you a better podcaster. Follow or subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or at soundoff.network.
Hear ye! Hear ye!
Produced by Cryer Media and distributed by the Sound Off Media Company.